Guests gathered around him, leaving the black leather lout with no one to torture.
"You must stop all of this!"
Ignatia shouted to Dorian, who was winking at the cowboy.
"Aside from the fact that I am witnessing a most egregious offense against taste and decency, I am also beginning to smother from the stench of glandular emissions and cologne."
"Oh, don't be so drab. They're just having fun."
"I am very sorry,"
Ignatia said in a businesslike tone.
"I am here tonight on a mission of the utmost seriousness. There is a girl who must be attended to, a bold and forward minx of a trollop. Now turn off that offensive music and quiet those sodomites. We must get down to brass tacks."
"I thought you were going to be fun. If you're just going to be tacky and dreary, then you'd better leave."
"I shall not leave. No one can deter me. Peace! Peace! Peace!"
"Oh, dear. You are serious about this, aren't you?"
Ignatius broke away from Dorian and rushed across the room, pushing through the elegant guests, and unplugged the phonograph. As he turned around, he was greeted by the guests' emasculated version of an Apache war cry.
"Beast!
Madman!
Is this what Dorian promised? That fantastic Lena!"
"The outfit, grotesque. And that earring. Oh, my."
"That was my very favorite thong."
"Horrible!"
"How unbelievably gross!"
"So monstrously huge!"
"A bad, bad dream!"
"Silence!"
Ignatius bellowed over their enraged babbling.
"I am here tonight, my friends, to show you how you may save the world and bring peace."
"He's truly mad."
"Dorian, what a bad joke. Where in the world did he come from?"
"Not even vaguely attractive."
"Filthy."
"Depressing." "Someone turn on that delicious record again."
"The challenge,"
Ignatius continued at full volume,
"is placed before you. Will you turn your singular talents to saving the world, or will you simply turn your backs on your fellow man?"
"Oh, how awful."
"Not at all amusing."
"I'd have to leave if this tacky charade continues."
"In such poor taste. Someone turn on that record again. Dear, dear Lena."
"Where's my coat?"
"Let's go to a smart bar."
"Look, I've spilled my martini on my most priceless jacket."
"Let's go to a smart bar."
"The world today is in a state of grave unrest,"
Ignatius screamed against the mewing and hissing. He paused for a moment to glance down in his pocket at some notes he had scribbled on a piece of Big Chief paper. Instead, he pulled out the torn and dog-eared photograph of Miss O'Hara. Several guests saw it and shrieked.
"We must prevent the apocalypse. We must fight fire with fire. Therefore, I turn to you."
"Oh, what in heaven's name is he talking about?"
"This is making me so depressed."
"Those eyes, they're frightening. Let's go to a smart bar."
"Let's go to San Francisco."
"Silence, you perverts!"
Ignatius cried.
"Listen to me!"
"Dorian,"
the cowboy pleaded in a lyric soprano,
"make him keep quiet. We were having such fun, such a grand, gay time. Oh, he's not even amusing."
"That's right," an extremely elegant guest, whose taut face was brown with suntan makeup, said.
"He's truly awful. So depressing."
"Must we listen to all of this?"
another guest asked, waving his cigarette as if it were a magic wand which would make Ignatius disappear.
"Is this a trick of some kind, Dorian? You know that we dearly love parties with a motif, but this... I mean, I never even watch the news on television. I've been working all day in that shop, and I don't want to come to a party and have to hear all of this sort of thing. Let him talk later if he really has to. His remarks are in such terrible taste."
"So inappropriate,"
the black leather lout sighed, turning suddenly fey.
"All right," Dorian said. "Turn on the record. I thought it might be fun."
He looked at Ignatius, who was snorting loudly.
"I'm afraid, my dears, that it turned out to be a terrible, terrible bomb."
"Wonderful.
Dorian's magnificent."
"There's the plug. I love Lena.
I truly think that this is her very best recording."
"So smart. Those special lyrics."
"I saw her in New York once. Magnificent."
"Play Gypsy next. I adore Ethel."
"Oh, good. It's coming on."
There Ignatia stood like the boy on the burning deck. The music rose from the tabernacle once again. Dorian fled to speak with a group of his guests, actively ignoring Ignatius, as was everyone else in the room. Ignatius felt as alone as he had felt on that dark day in high school when in a chemistry laboratory his experiment had exploded, burning his eyebrows off and frightening him. The shock and terror had made him wet his pants, and no one in the laboratory would notice him, not even the instructor, who hated him sincerely for similar explosions in the past. For the remainder of that day, as he walked soggily around the school, everyone had pretended that he was invisible. Ignatius, feeling just as invisible standing there in Dorian's living room, began feinting at some imaginary opponent with his cutlass to relieve his self-consciousness. Many were now singing with the record. Two began dancing near the phonograph. The dancing spread like a forest fire, and soon the floor was filled with couples who swayed and dipped around the Gibraltar of a wallflower, Ignatius. As Dorian swept past in the arms of the cowboy, Ignatius tried futilely to attract his attention. He attempted even to stick the cowboy with his cutlass, but the two were a wily and elusive dance team. Just as he was about to evanesce completely, Frida, Liz, and Betty burst in from the kitchen.
"We couldn't take that kitchen anymore," Frida said to Ignatius. "After all, we're human beings, too."
She gave Ignatius a light punch to the stomach.
"Looks like you're left out, Fats."
"Just what do you mean?" Ignatius asked haughtily.
"Looks like your costume's not going over too well," Liz observed.
"Pardon me, ladies. I must leave."
"Hey, don't go, Tubby," Betty said. "Somebody'll ask you. They're just trying to bitch you. Don't give up the ship. They'd bitch their own mother."
At that moment, Timmy, who had slipped out to the slave quarters again to look for his missing charm bracelet, and, he hoped, more games with the chains, appeared in the living room. He wandered over to Ignatius and asked wistfully,
"Do you want to dance?"
"There, you see!"
Frida said to Ignatius.
"I want to see this," Liz shouted. "Let's see you two do the limbo. Come on, I'll get a broom we can use for the pole."
"Oh my God," Ignatius said. "Please, I don't dance."
"Oh, come on," Timmy said. "I can teach you. I love to dance. I'll lead."
"Go ahead, big ass," Betty threatened.
"No, it would be impossible. The cutlass, the smock, someone would be injured. I came here to speak, not dance. I don't dance. I never dance. I have never danced in my life."
"Well, you're going to dance now," Frida told him. "You don't want to hurt this sailor's feelings."
"I am not dancing," Ignatius barked. "I have never danced, and I certainly am not going to begin with some drunken deviant."
"Oh, don't be so straight," Timmy sighed.
"I have always had a rather substandard sense of balance," Ignatius explained. "We will plunge to the floor in a broken heap. This deranged mariner will be crippled or worse."
"Tubby looks like a troublemaker," Frida said to her friends. "Right?"
With a wink from Frida, the three girls attacked Ignatius. One wrapped a square leg around his, the other kicked him in the back of the knee, the third pushed him backward onto the cowboy, who was whirling in the vicinity. Ignatius steadied himself by grabbing the cowboy, who broke from Dorian's horrified grasp and toppled to the floor. As the cowboy landed, the needle jumped from the record and the music stopped. But in its place there began a chorus of shrieking and screaming from the guests.
"Oh, Dorian, get him out!"
An elegant shrieked in panic. There was a metallic crash of rings, bracelets, and cufflinks as some of the guests pressed together in a corner.
"Hey, you knocked that bitch of a cowboy over like a tin pin!"
Frida screamed admiringly at Ignatius, who was still flailing his arms to regain his balance.
"Nice work, Fats," Liz said.
"Let's aim him at somebody else,"
Betty said to her companions.
"What have you done, you huge beastly thing?"
Dorian cried at Ignatius.
"This is an outrage,"
Ignatius was shouting.
"I have not only been ignored and vilified at this gathering, I have been viciously attacked within the walls of your cobweb of a home. I hope that you carry liability insurance. If not, you may well lose this flamboyant property once my legal advisers have attended to you.
Dorian was down on his knees, fanning the cowboy, whose lids were beginning to flutter.
Make him leave, Dorian, the cowboy sobbed. He almost killed me.
I had thought you might be different and funny, Dorian hissed at Ignatius. As it is, you have proved to be the most awful thing that has ever been in my house. From the moment that you broke the door, I should have realized that it would end like this. What did you do to this dear boy?
My trousers are filthy,
the cowboy shrieked.
I was savagely attacked and pushed onto that coxcomb cowpoke.
Don't try to lie, Fats, Frida said. We saw the whole thing. He was jealous, Dorian. He wanted to dance with you.
Awful. Make him go.
Ruining the party.
So monstrous. Dangerous.
Total loss.
Get out!
Dorian cried.
We'll handle him,
Frida said.
All right,
Ignatius said grandly, as the three girls sank their stubby hands into his smock and started propelling him toward the door.
You have made your choice. Live in a world of war and bloodshed. When the bomb drops, do not come to me. I shall be in my shelter.
Can it?
Betty said. The three girls hustled Ignatius through the door and down the carriageway.
Thank Fortuna, I'm dissociating myself from this movement,
Ignatius thundered. The girls had knocked the scarf down over one eye, and he was having trouble seeing where he was going.
You distempered people hardly have voter appeal.
They pushed him through the gate and onto the sidewalk. The Spanish dagger plants at the gate pricked his calves painfully, and he stumbled forward.
Okay, Buster,
Frida called through the gate as she closed it.
We're giving you a 10 minutes head start. Then we start combing the quarter.
We better not find your fat ass, Liz said.
Shove off, Tubby, Betty added. We haven't had a good fight in a long time. We're ready for one.
Your movement is doomed,
Ignatius slobbered after the girls, who were pushing one another down the carriageway.
Do you hear me? D-O-O-M-E-D. You know nothing about politics and voter persuasion. You will not carry a single ward in the nation. You won't even carry the quarter.
The door slammed, and the girls were back in the party, which seemed to have regained its momentum. The music had started again, and Ignatius heard the squealing and shrieking growing louder than before. He knocked on the black shutters with his cutlass, screaming,
"You will lose!"
The tap and slide of many dancing feet answered his cry. A man wearing a silk suit and a Homburg came out of the shadow of an adjoining doorway for a moment to see whether the girls had gone. Then the man slipped back into the darkness, watching Ignatius, who was waddling back and forth before the building furiously. Ignatius's valve responded to his emotions by plopping closed. His hand sympathized by sprouting a rich growth of tiny white bumps that itched maddeningly. What could he tell Myrna about the movement for peace now? Now, like the abortive crusade for Moorish dignity, he had another debacle on his itching hands. Fortuna, that vicious slut. The evening had hardly begun. He couldn't return to Constantinople Street and a variety of assaults from his mother, not now that his emotions had been stimulated toward a climax that had been snatched from his grasp. For almost a week he had been preoccupied with the kickoff rally, and now, ejected from the political arena by three dubious girls, he stood frustrated and furious on the damp flagstones of St. Peter Street. Looking at his Mickey Mouse wristwatch, which was, as usual, moribund, he wondered what time it was. Perhaps it was still early enough to see the first show at the Night of Joy. Perhaps Miss O'Hara had opened. If he and Myrna were not destined to joust on the field of political action, then it would have to be the field of sex. What a lance Miss O'Hara could be to hurl right between Myrna's offensive eyes. Ignatius looked at the photograph once more, salivating slightly. What kind of pet? The evening could still be wrenched from the jaws of failure. Scratching one paw with the other, he decided that safety, at least, dictated his moving along. Those three savage girls might make good their threat. He billowed off down St. Peter toward Bourbon. The man in the silk suit and Homburg came out of the shadow of the doorway and followed him. At Bourbon, Ignatius turned and began walking up toward Canal through the night's parade of tourists and quarterites, among whom he did not look particularly strange. He shoved through the crowd on the narrow sidewalk, his hips swinging each way free and slamming people aside. When Myrna read of Miss O'Hara, she would spew espresso all over the letter in consternation. As he crossed onto the Knight of Joy's block, he heard the doped Negro calling,
"Whoa! Come in! See Miss Harlow O'Hara dancing with her pet! Guarantee 100% real plantation dancing! Every motherfucking drink got a guaranteed knockout drop! Whoa! Everybody guaranteed to catch them some clap off their glass! Hey! Nobody never seen nothing like Miss Harlow O'Hara Old South Pet dancing! Open at night tonight! Maybe this be your one and only chance to catch this act! Ooh-wee!"
Ignatius saw him through the crowd that was hurrying past the Knight of Joy. Apparently no one was heeding the barker's plea. The barker himself had paused in his calling to emit a nimbus formation of smoke. He was wearing tails and a stovepipe hat that rested at an angle above his dark glasses, smiling through the smoke at the people who resisted his appeals.
"Hey! All you pips dragging along here! Stop and come stick your ass on a Knight of Joy stool!"
He started again.
"Knight of Joy got genuine colored pips working below the minimum wage. Whoa! Guaranteed plantation atmosphere. Got cotton growing right on the stage, right in front of your eyeball. Got a civil right worker getting his ass beat up between show. Hey!"
"Is Miss O'Hara on yet?"
Ignatius slobbered at the barker's elbow.
"Ooh-wee!"
The fat mother had arrived. In person.
"Hey, man, how come you still wearing that earring and a scarf? What you supposed to be, anyway?"
"Please."
Ignatius rattled his cutlass a bit.
"I haven't time to chat. I have no success pointers for you tonight, I'm afraid. Has Miss O'Hara begun?"
"She'd be starting in a few minutes. You better get your ass in there and get you a ringside seat. I talked to the head waiter. He say he have a table all reserved for you."
"Is that true?"
Ignatius asked eagerly.
"The Nazi proprietress is gone, I hope."
"She jet away to California this afternoon. Say Harlow O'Hara's so good she gonna go dip her ass in the ocean a while and stop worrying about her club."
"Wonderful, wonderful."
"Come on, man. Get inside before the show start. Whoa! You don't want to miss 1 minute. Shit. Harlow coming on in a few seconds. Go get yourself right down by that motherfucking stage. See every goosebump on Miss O'Hara bum."
Jones propelled Ignatius rapidly through the padded door. Ignatius stumbled into the Knight of Joy with such momentum that his smock swirled around his ankles. Even in the darkness, he noticed that the Knight of Joy was somewhat dirtier than it had been on his previous visit. There was certainly enough dirt on the floor to permit a very limited cotton crop, but he saw no cotton. That must have been one of the Knight of Joy's vicious come-ons. He looked about for the head waiter and saw none, so he lumbered through the few old men scattered about at tables in the gloom and seated himself at a small table directly beneath the stage. His cap looked like a solitary green footlight. At this close range, he could perhaps make some gesture to Miss O'Hara or whisper something about Boethius that would attract her attention. She would be overwhelmed when she realized that there was a kindred spirit in the audience. Ignatius glanced about at the handful of empty-eyed men seated in the place. Miss O'Hara certainly had to cast her pearls before a dismal lot of swine, who looked like the type of vague, drawn old man who molested children at matinees. A three-piece band in the wings of the tiny stage was beginning to thump through "You Are My Lucky Star." At the moment, the stage, which itself looked a bit dirty, was empty of orgiasts. Ignatius looked over at the bar to try to attract some sort of service and caught the eye of the bartender who had served his mother and him. The bartender pretended not to see him. Then Ignatius winked wildly at a woman leaning on the bar, a 40-ish Latin who leered a terrifying response with a gold tooth or two. She pried herself loose from the bar before the bartender could stop her and came over to Ignatius, who was huddled against the stage as if it were a warm stove.
"You want a drink, Chico?"
Some halitosis filtered through his mustache. He ripped the scarf from his cap and shielded his nostrils with it.
"Thank you, yes.
he said in a muffled voice.
A Dr. Nutt, if you please. And be certain that it's frosty cold.
I see what we have,
the woman said enigmatically, and clopped back to the bar in her straw sandals. Ignatius watched her speak to the bartender in pantomime. They made a variety of gestures, most of which were directed at Ignatius. At least, Ignatius thought, he would be safe in this den if the sinewy girls were out prowling the quarter. The bartender and the woman made some more signs, then she clopped back to Ignatius with two bottles of champagne and two glasses.
We no have Dr. Nutt,
she said and slammed the tray on the table.
Mira, you are our $24 for dear champagne.
This is an outrage!
He directed a few swipes of the cutlass at the woman.
Bring me a Coke.
No Coke, no nothing. Only champagne.
The woman took a seat at the table.
Come on, honey. Open the champagne. I am very thirsty.
Again, the breath wafted toward Ignatius, who pressed the scarf to his nose so tightly that he felt he would suffocate. He would catch some germ from this woman that would speed to his brain and transform him into a mongoloid. Misused Miss O'Hara. Trapped with subhuman women as co-workers. Of necessity, Miss O'Hara's Boethian detachment must be rather lofty. The Latin woman dropped the check in Ignatius's lap.
Don't you dare touch me!
He bellowed through the scarf.
Ave Maria! Che patto!
The woman said to herself. Then she said,
Mira, you are pan now, maricon. We'll throw you out on your big culo.
Such grace, Ignatius mumbled. Well, I did not come here to drink with you. Now get away from my table.
He breathed deeply through the mouth.
And take your champagne with you.
Oye, loco, you are.
The woman's threat was submerged by the band, which emitted a debilitated fanfare of sorts. Lana Lee appeared on the stage in what looked like gold lamé overalls.
Oh, my God!
Ignatius spluttered. The doped Negro had tricked him. He wanted to bolt from the club, but realized that it would be wiser to wait until the woman had finished and left the stage. In a moment, he was crouched down against the side of the stage. Over his head, the Nazi proprietress was saying,
Welcome, ladies and genitals.
It was so dreadful a beginning that Ignatius almost knocked over the table.
You are pay me now,
the woman was demanding, sticking her head under the table to find the face of her customer.
Shut up, you slut,
Ignatius hissed. The band stumbled into a four-count version of Sophisticated Lady. The Nazi woman was screaming,
And now that pure Virginia Belle, Miss Harlot O'Hara.
An old man at one of the tables clapped feebly, and Ignatius peered over the rim of the stage and saw that the proprietress was gone. In her place stood a stand decorated with rings. What was Miss O'Hara up to? Then Darlene swept on stage in a ball gown that trailed yards of nylon net. On her head was a monstrous picture hat, and on her arm a monstrous bird. Someone else clapped.
Mira, you are pay me now or else, cabron!
There sure was plenty balls at that ball, but I still got my honor,
Darlene said carefully to the bird.
Oh, my God!
Ignatius bellowed, unable to remain silent any longer.
Is this cretin Harlot O'Hara?
The cockatoo noticed him before Darlene did, for its beads of eyes had been focusing on Ignatius's hoop of a novelty earring ever since it had come on stage. When Ignatius bellowed, it flapped from Darlene's arm to the stage, and squawking, hopping, dashed for Ignatius's head.
Hey!
Darlene cried.
It's the crazy man!
As Ignatius was about to dash from the club, the bird hopped from the stage to his shoulder. It sank its claws into his smock and snagged his earring with its beak.
Good heavens!
Ignatius leaped up and beat at the bird with his itching paws. What avian menace had depraved Fortuna spun his way? The champagne bottles and the glasses shattered on the floor as he sprang and began staggering to the door.
Come back here with my cockatoo!
Darlene cried. Lana Lee was on the stage now, screaming. The band had stopped. The few old male patrons moved out of the way of Ignatius, who was floundering around among the little tables, making moose calls and beating at the mass of rose feathers welded to his ear and shoulder.
How in the hell did that character get in here?
Lana Lee asked the confused septuagenarians in the audience.
Where's Jones? Somebody get me that Jones!
Come here, you big crazy man!
Darlene hollered.
On opening night? Why you had to come here on opening night?
Good grief!
Ignatius gasped, feeling for the door. In his wake, he had left a trail of overturned tables.
How dare you fiends inflict a rabid bird upon your unsuspecting customers? You may expect to be sued in the morning.
Come. You are owe $24 to me. You are pay right now.
Ignatius knocked over another table as he and the cockatoo lurched forward. Then he felt the earring loosening, and the cockatoo, the earring firmly in its beak, fell from his shoulder. Terrorized, Ignatius bounced out of the door just ahead of the Latin woman, who was waving the check with great determination.
Whoa! Hey!
Ignatius stumbled past Jones, who had never expected the sabotage to assume such dramatic proportions. Gasping, clutching his cemented valve, Ignatius continued forward onto the street and into the path of an oncoming Desire bus. He first heard the people on the sidewalk screaming. Then he heard the pounding tires and the crying brakes, and when he glanced up, he was blinded by headlights a few feet from his eyes. The headlights swam and faded from his sight as he fainted. He would have fallen directly before the bus if Jones hadn't leaped into the street and pulled at the white smock with his two large hands. Ignatius instead fell backward, and the bus, exhaling diesel exhaust, rumbled past an inch or two from his desert boots.
"Is he dead?"
Lana Lee asked hopefully, studying the mound of white material lying in the street.
"I am hope not. He is owe $24, the maricon."
"Hey, wake up, man!"
Jones said, blowing some smoke over the inert figure. The man in the silk suit in Hamburg stepped from an alleyway, where he had hidden himself when he saw Ignatius enter the night of joy. Ignatius's departure from the club had been so violent and rapid that the man had been too startled to act until now.
"Let me take a look at him,"
the man in the Hamburg said, bending over and listening to Ignatius's heart. A kettle drum of a thump told him that life still breathed within the yards of White Smock. He held Ignatius's wrist. The Mickey Mouse watch was smashed.
"He's okay. He just passed out."
The man cleared his throat and ordered weakly,
"Everybody back. Give him air."
The street was filled with people, and the bus had stopped a few yards down the street, blocking traffic. Suddenly, it looked like Bourbon Street at Mardi Gras. Through the darkness of his glasses, Jones looked at the stranger. He looked familiar, like a well-dressed version of someone Jones had seen before. The weak eyes were most familiar. Jones remembered the same weak eyes on top of a red beard. Then he remembered the same eyes under a blue cap in the precinct on the day of the cashew nut incident. He said nothing. A policeman was a policeman. It was always best to ignore them unless they bothered you.
"Where he come from?"
Darlene was asking the crowd. The rose cockatoo rested once again on her arm, the earring dangling from its beak like a golden worm.
"What a opening night! What are we gonna do, Lana?"
"Nothing," Lana said angrily. "Let that character lay there till the street sweeper comes around. Then let me get my hands on Jones."
"Whoa, hey! That cat forced his way in. We was fighting and grappling, but that mutter seemed determined to get into Night of Joy. I was a scare I'd be ripping this costume you rented. You'd be having to pay for it. Night of Joy be going broke. Whoa!"
"Shut your smart mouth. I think I'm gonna have to call up all my pals at the precinct. You're fired. Darlene, too. I knew I shouldn't have let you get on my stage. Get that goddamn bird off my sidewalk."
Lana turned to the crowd.
Well, folks, now that you're all here, how about coming into the Night of Joy? We got a class show.
Mia Lee?
The Latin woman inflicted a little halitosis on Lana Lee.
Who is paid the $24 for champagne?
You're fired too, you dumb spick.
Lana smiled.
Come on in, folks, and enjoy a good drink made by our expert mixologist to your exact specifications.
The crowd, however, was craning at the white mound, which was wheezing loudly, and declined the invitation to elegance. Lana Lee was about to go over and kick the mound into consciousness and get it out of her gutter, when the man in the Homburg said politely,
I'd like to use your telephone. Maybe I'd better call a ambulance.
Lana looked at the silk suit, the hat, the weak, insecure eyes. She could spot a safe one, a soft touch, all right. A rich doctor, a lawyer. She might be able to turn this little fiasco into a profit.
Sure, she whispered. Look, you don't want to waste your evening messing with that character laying in the street. He's some kind of bum. You look like you could use you some fun.
She stepped around the white mountain of smock, which was wheezing and snorting volcanically. Somewhere in Fantasyland, Ignatius was dreaming of a terrified Myrna Minkoff being tried by a court of taste and decency and found wanting. A dreadful sentence was about to be pronounced, something guaranteeing physical injury to her person as penance for innumerable offenses. Lana Lee got close to the man and reached into her gold lamé overalls. She squatted next to him and surreptitiously flashed the Boethian photograph cupped in her hand.
Take a look at this, baby. How'd you like to spend the evening with that?
The man in the Homburg turned his eyes from Ignatius's whitened face and looked at the woman, the book, the globe, the chalk. He cleared his throat once more and said,
I'm Patrolman Mancuso, undercover agent. You're under arrest for soliciting and for possession of pornography.
Just then, the three members of the defunct lady's auxiliary, Frida, Betty, and Liz, stomped into the crowd surrounding Ignatius. Chapter 13 Ignatius opened his eyes and saw white floating above him. He had a headache and his ear was throbbing. Then his blue and yellow eyes focused slowly, and through his headache, he realized that he was looking at a ceiling.
So you finally woke up, boy,
his mother's voice said near him.
Just take a look at this. Now we're really ruined.
Where am I?
Don't start acting smart with me, boy. Don't start with me, Ignatius. I'm warning you. I had enough. I mean it. How am I going to face people after this?
Ignatius turned his head and looked about him. He was lying in a little cell formed by screens on either side. He saw a nurse pass by the foot of the bed.
Good heavens! I'm in a hospital. Who is my doctor? I hope that you have been selfless enough to secure the services of a specialist. And a priest. Have one come. I'll see whether he's acceptable.
Ignatius sprayed a little nervous saliva on the sheet that snow-capped the peak of his stomach. He touched his head and felt a bandage plastered over his headache.
Oh, my God! Don't be afraid to tell me, Mother. I can tell from the pain that it must be rather fatal.
Shut up and take a look at this!
Mrs. Riley almost shouted, throwing a newspaper on Ignatius's bandage.
Nurse!
Mrs. Riley tore the newspaper from his face and slapped her hand over his mustache.
Now shut up, crazy, and take a look at this here paper!
Her voice was cracking.
We're ruined!
Under the headline that said, Wild Incident on Bourbon Street, Ignatius saw three photographs lined up together. On the right, Darlene with her ball gown was holding the cockatoo and smiling a starlit smile. On the left, Lana Lee covered her face with her hands as she climbed into the rear seat of a squad car, already filled with the three cropped heads of the members of the ladies' auxiliary of the peace party. Patrolman Mancuso, in a torn suit and a hat with a bent rim, purposefully held open the door of the car. In the center, the doped Negro was grinning at what looked like a dead cow lying in the street. Ignatius scrutinized the center photograph through slitted eyes.
Just look at that! He thundered. What sort of clause does that newspaper employ on its photographic staff? My features are barely distinguishable.
Read what it says underneath the pictures, boy.
Mrs. Riley stuck a finger into the newspaper as if she meant to lance the photograph.
Just read it, Ignatius. What you think people are saying on Constantinople Street? Go on. Read that out loud to me, boy. A big brawl out on the street? Dirty pictures? Ladies of the evening? It's all there. Read it, boy.
I'd rather not. It's probably full of falsification and smear. The yellow journalists doubtlessly suggested all sorts of lip-smacking innuendos.
Nevertheless, Ignatius treated the story to a desultory reading.
Do you mean to tell me that they claim that that wayward bus did not hit me?
He asked angrily.
The very first comment is a lie. Contact public service. We must sue.
Shut up. Read the whole thing.
A stripper's bird had attacked a hot dog vendor wearing a costume. A. Mancuso, undercover, had arrested Lana Lee for soliciting and for possession of and posing for pornography. Burma Jones, porter, had led A. Mancuso to a cabinet under the bar where pornographic materials were discovered. A. Mancuso told reporters that he had been working on the case for some time, that he had already contacted one of the Lee woman's agents. Police suspect that the arrest of the Lee woman broke a citywide high school pornography distribution syndicate. Police found a list of schools in the bar. A. Mancuso said that the agent would be sought. While A. Mancuso was performing the arrest, three women, Club, Steel, and Bumper, emerged from the large crowd before the club and assaulted him. They were also booked. Ignatius Jacques Riley, 30, was removed to a hospital to be treated for shock.
It's our bad luck they had a photographer hanging around doing nothing they could send out to take a picture of you laying in the street like a drunk bum.
Mrs. Riley began to sniffle.
I should have known something like this was going to happen with your dirty pictures and running off dressed up like a Mardi Gras.
I ran off into the most dismal night of my life.
Ignatius sighed.
Fortuna was really spinning drunkenly last night. I doubt whether I can go much farther down.
He belched.
May I ask what that cretin nemesis of a policeman was doing on the scene?
Last night after you run off, I rung up Santa and told her to get Angelo at the precinct and for him to go see what you was doing down on St. Peter Street. I heard you give a address to that taxi man.
How clever.
I thought you was going to a meeting with a bunch of communists. Was I wrong? Angelo says you was hanging around with some funny people.
In other words, you are having me trailed,
Ignatius screamed.
My own mother!
Attacked by a bird, Mrs. Riley wept. That had to happen to you, Ignatius. Nobody never gets attacked by a bird.
Where is that bus driver? He must be indicted immediately.
You just fainted, stupid.
Then why this bandage? I don't feel at all well. I must have damaged some vital part when I fell to the street.
You just scraped your head a little. There's nothing wrong with you. They took x-rays.
Have people been fooling with my body while I was unconscious? You might have had the good taste to stop them. Heaven knows where these salacious medical people have been probing.
Ignatius now realized that in addition to the head and ear, an erection had been bothering him ever since he had awakened. It was demanding attention.
Would you mind leaving my booth for a moment while I inspect myself to see whether I've been mishandled? 5 minutes should be sufficient.
Look, Ignatius.
Mrs. Riley rose from the chair and grabbed Ignatius by the collar of the clown-like dotted pajamas that had been put on him.
Don't act smart with me or I'll slap your face off. Angelo told me all about it. A boy with your education bumming around with funny people down in the quarter, going into a bar room to look for a lady of the evening.
Mrs. Riley cried anew.
We just lucky the whole thing's not in the paper. We'd have to move out of town.
You're the one who introduced my innocent being to that den of a bar. Actually, it's all the fault of that dreadful girl, Myrna. She must be punished for her misdeeds.
Myrna?
Mrs. Riley sobbed.
She ain't even in town. I heard enough of your crazy stories already about how she got you fired out of Levy Pants. You can't do this to me no more. You're crazy, Ignatius. Even if I gotta say it. My own child out his mind.
You look rather haggard. Why don't you push someone aside and crawl into one of the beds around here and take a nap? Call again in about an hour.
I've been up all night. When Angelo rang me up and said you was in the hospital, I almost took a stroke. I almost fell down on the kitchen floor, right on my head. I could have split my skull wide open. Then I run into my room to get dressed and I sprained my ankle. I almost got in a wreck driving over here.
Not another wreck, Ignatius gasped. I would have to go to work in the salt mines this time.
Here, stupid. Angelo says to give this to you.
Mrs. Riley reached down next to her chair and picked from the floor the large volume of The Consolation of Philosophy. She aimed one of its corners at Ignatius's stomach.
Ugh!
Ignatius gurgled.
Angelo found it in that barroom last night, Mrs. Riley said boldly. Somebody stole it off him in the toilet.
Oh, my God! This has all been arranged!
Ignatius screamed, rattling the huge edition in his paws.
I see it all now. I told you long ago that that mongoloid Mancuso was our nemesis. Now he has struck his final blow. How innocent I was to lend him this book. How I've been duped!
He closed his bloodshot eyes and slobbered incoherently for a moment.
Taken in by a Third Reich strumpet, hiding her depraved face behind my very own book, the very basis of my world view. Oh, Mother, if only you knew how cruelly I've been tricked by a conspiracy of subhumans. Ironically, the Book of Fortuna is itself bad luck. Oh, Fortuna, you degenerate wanton!
Shut up!
Mrs. Riley shouted, her powdered face lined by anger.
You want the whole recovery ward coming in here? What do you think Miss Annie's going to say now? How am I going to face people, you stupid, crazy Ignatius? Now this hospital wants $20 before I can take you out of here. The ambulance driver couldn't take you to the charity like a nice man. No, he has to come dump you here in a pay hospital. Where you think I got $20? I got meet a note on your trumpet tomorrow. I got to pay that man for his building.
That is outrageous. You will certainly not pay $20. It is highway robbery. Now run along home and leave me here. It's rather peaceful. I may recover eventually. It's exactly what my psyche needs at the moment. When you have a chance, bring me some pencils and the loose leaf folder you'll find on my desk. I must record this trauma while it's still fresh in my mind. You have my permission to enter my room. Now, if you'll pardon me, I must rest.
Rest? And pay another $20 for another day? Get up out that bed. I called up Claude. He's coming down here and pay your bill.
Claude? Who in the world is Claude?
A man I know.
Well, understand one thing right now. No strange man is going to pay my hospital bill. I shall stay here until honest money buys my freedom.
Get up out that bed!
Mrs. Riley hollered. She snatched at the pajamas, but the body was sunken into the mattress like a meteor.
Get up before I smack your fat face off!
When he saw his mother's purse rising over his head, he sat up.
Oh, my God! You're wearing your bowling shoes!
Ignatius cast a pink and blue and yellow eye over the side of the bed down past his mother's hanging slip and drooping cotton stockings.
Only you would wear bowling shoes to your child's sickbed!
But his mother did not rise to the challenge. She had the determination, the superiority that comes with intense anger. Her eyes were steely, her lips thin and firm. Everything was going wrong. Mr. Clyde looked at the morning paper and fired Riley. The big ape's career as a vendor was finished. Why was that baboon wearing his outfit when he was off duty? One ape like Riley could demolish 10 years of trying to build up a decent commercial name. Hot dog vendors had an image problem already, without one of them passing out in the street by a whorehouse. Mr. Clyde and the cauldron bubbled and boiled. If Riley tried to show up at Paradise Vendors Incorporated again, he would really get it in the throat with the fork. But there were those smocks and that pirate gear. Riley must have smuggled the pirate gimmicks out of the garage the afternoon before. He would have to contact the big ape after all, if only to tell him not to come around. You really couldn't expect to get your uniforms back from an animal like Riley. Mr. Clyde telephoned the number on Constantinople Street several times and got no answer. Maybe they had put him away somewhere. The big ape's mother must be dead drunk on the floor somewhere.
Christ only knew what she was like. It must be quite a family. Dr. Talc had been having a miserable week. Somehow, the students had found one of those threats that psychotic graduate student had flooded him with a few years before. How it got into their hands, he didn't know. The results were already awful. An underground of rumors about the note was slowly spreading. He was becoming the butt of the campus. At a cocktail party, one of his colleagues had finally explained to him the reason for the laughter and whispering that were disrupting his previously respectful classes. That business in the note about misleading and perverting the young had been badly misunderstood and misinterpreted. He wondered if he might have to explain to the administration eventually. And that phrase, underdeveloped testicles. Dr. Talc cringed. Bringing the whole matter into the open might be the best plan, but that would mean trying to find that former student, who was the sort who would deny all responsibility anyway. Perhaps he should simply try to describe what Mr. Riley had been like. Dr. Talc saw again Mr. Riley with his massive muffler and that awful girl anarchist with the valise, who traveled around with Mr. Riley and littered the campus with leaflets. Fortunately, she hadn't stayed at the college too long, although that Riley seemed as if he were planning to make himself a fixture on the campus, like the palm trees and the benches. Dr. Talc had them both in separate classes one grim semester, during which they had disrupted his lectures with strange noises and impertinent, venomous questions that no one, aside from God, could possibly have answered. He shuddered. In spite of everything, he must reach Riley and extract an explanation and confession. One look at Mr. Riley and the students would understand that the note was the meaningless fantasy of a sick mind. He could even let the administration look at Mr. Riley. The solution was, after all, really a physical one, producing Mr. Riley in the abundant flesh. Dr. Talc sipped the vodka and V8 juice that he always had after a night of heavy social drinking and looked at his newspaper. At least the people in the quarter were having rowdy fun. He sipped his drink and remembered the incident of Mr. Riley's dumping all of those examination papers on the heads of that freshman demonstration beneath the windows of the faculty office building. The administration would remember it, too. He smiled complacently and looked at the paper again. The three photographs were hilarious. Common, bawdy people, at a distance, had always amused him. He read the article and choked, spitting liquid onto his smoking jacket. How had Riley ever sunk so low? He had been eccentric as a student, but now... How much worse the rumors would be if it were discovered that the note had been written by a hot dog vendor. Riley was the sort who would come to the campus with his wagon and try to sell hot dogs right before the social studies building. He would deliberately turn the affair into a three-ring circus. It would be a disgraceful farce in which he, Talc, would become the clown. Dr. Talc put down his paper and his glass and covered his face with his hands. He would have to live with that note. He would deny everything. Miss Annie looked at her morning newspaper and turned red. She had been wondering why it was so quiet over at the Riley household this morning. Well, this was the last straw. Now the neighborhood was getting a bad name. She couldn't take it anymore. Those people had to move. She'd get the neighbors to sign a petition. Patrolman Mancuso looked at the newspaper again. Then he held it to his chest, and the flashbulb popped. He had brought his own Brownie Holiday camera to the precinct and asked the sergeant to photograph him against certain official backdrops. The sergeant's desk, the steps of the precinct, a squad car, a traffic patrolwoman whose specialty was school zone speeders. When there was only one exposure left, Patrolman Mancuso decided to combine two of the props for a dramatic finale. While the traffic patrolwoman, pretending to be Lana Lee, climbed into the rear of the squad car, grimacing and shaking a vengeful fist, Patrolman Mancuso faced the camera with his newspaper and frowned sternly.
"Okay, Angelo, is that all?"
the patrolwoman asked, eager to get to a nearby school before the morning speed zone hours ended.
"Thank you very much, Gladys," Patrolman Mancuso said. "My kids wanted to get some more pictures to show their little friends."
"Well, sure,"
Gladys called, hurrying out of the precinct yard.
her shoulder bag bursting with black speeding tickets.
I guess they got a right to be proud of their papa. I'm glad I could help you out, honey. Anytime you want to take you some more pictures, just give me the word.
The sergeant tossed the last flashbulb into a trash can and clamped his hand on Patrolman Mancuso's vertical shoulder.
Single-handed, you break up the city's most active high school pornography racket.
He slapped his hand on the incline of Patrolman Mancuso's shoulder blade.
Mancuso, of all people, brings in a woman even our best plainclothesman couldn't fool. Mancuso, I find out, has been working on this case on the QT. Mancuso can identify one of her agents. Who's the person really been going out on his own all the time looking for characters like those three girls and trying to bring them in? Mancuso, that's who.
Patrolman Mancuso's olive skin flushed slightly, except in limited areas scratched by the Peace Party auxiliary. There it was simply red.
Just luck?
Patrolman Mancuso offered, clearing his throat of some invisible phlegm.
Somebody give me a lead to the place. Then that Burma Jones told me to look in that cabinet under the bar. You staged a one-man raid, Angelo.
Angelo? He turned a spectrum of shades between orange and violet.
I wouldn't be surprised if you was to get a promotion for this,
the sergeant said.
You've been a patrolman a pretty long time, and just a couple days ago I was thinking you was a horse's ass. How about that? What do you say to that, Mancuso?
Patrolman Mancuso cleared his throat very violently.
Can I have my camera back?
He asked almost incoherently when his larynx was at last clear. Santa Battaglia held the newspaper up to her mother's picture and said,
How you like that, babe? How you like the way your grandson Angelo made good? You like that, darling?
She pointed to another photograph.
How you like poor Irene's crazy boy laying there in the gutter like a washed-up whale? Ain't that sad? That girl's gotta get that boy put away this time. You think any man's gonna marry Irene with that big bum laying around the house? Of course not.
Santa snatched at her mother's picture and gave it a moist smack.
Take it easy, babe. I'm praying for you.
Claude Robichaud looked at the newspaper with a heavy heart as he rode the streetcar to the hospital. How could that big boy disgrace a fine, sweet woman like Irene? Already she was pale and tired from worrying about her son. Santa was right. That son of Irene's had to be treated before he brought any more disgrace to his wonderful mother. This time it was only $20. Next time it might be much more. Even with a nice pension and some properties, a person couldn't afford a stepson like that. But worst of all was the disgrace. George was pasting the article in the junior achievement scrapbook that was one of his mementos from his last semester at school. He pasted it on an empty page between his biology drawing of the aorta of a duck and his civics project on the history of the Constitution. He had to give it to that Mancuso guy. He was really on the ball. George wondered if his name was on that list the cops had found in the cabinet. If it was, it might be a good idea to go visit his uncle who lived on the coast. Even then they'd have his name. He really didn't have enough money to go anywhere. The best thing was to stay at home for a while. That Mancuso might spot him if he went downtown. George's mother, vacuuming on the other side of the living room, hopefully watched her son work on his school scrapbook. Maybe he was getting interested in school again. She and his father didn't seem to be able to do anything with him. What chance did a boy without a high school education have nowadays? What could he do? She turned off the vacuum cleaner and answered the doorbell. George was studying the photographs and wondering what that vendor had been doing at the Night of Joy. He couldn't have been some kind of police agent. Anyway, George hadn't told him where the pictures came from. There was something funny about the whole business.
The police?
George heard his mother asking at the door.
You must have the wrong apartment.
George started for the kitchen before he realized that there was nowhere to go. The apartments in the housing project had only one door. Lana Lee tore the newspaper into shreds, and then tore the shreds into smaller shreds. When the matron stopped by the cell to tell her to clean it up, the members of the ladies' auxiliary, all three of whom were sharing the cell, said to the matron,
"Beat it! We're the ones living in this place. We like paper on the floor."
"Shove off," Liz added.
"Get lost,"
Betty said.
"I'll take care of this cell, all right,"
the matron answered.
"You four have been making noise ever since you came in last night."
"Get me out this goddamn hole!"
Lana Lee screamed at the matron.
"I can't take another minute with these three bats."
"Hey,"
Frida said to her two apartment mates.
"Doll doesn't like us."
"It's people like you been running the quarter,"
Lana told Frida.
"Shut up," Liz said to her.
"Can it, sweets?"
Betty said.
"Get me out of here!"
Lana screamed through the bars.
"I just been through one fucking hell of a night with these three creeps. I got my rights. You can't stick me in here."
The matron smiled at her and walked away.
"Hey!"
Lana screamed down the corridor.
"Come back here!"
"Take it easy, dearie,"
Frida advised.
"Quit rocking the boat.
Now come on and show us those pictures of yourself you got hidden in your bra."
"Yeah," Liz said.
"Get out the snapshots, doll,"
Betty ordered.
"We're tired of looking at these friggin' walls."
The three girls lunged for Lana at the same time. Dorian Green turned one of his severe calling cards over and printed on the reverse side, "Stunning apartment for rent. Apply at 1A. He stepped out onto the flagstone sidewalk and tacked the card to the bottom of one of the black patent leather shutters. The girls would be gone for quite a while this time. Police were always so adamant about second offenses. It was unfortunate that the girls had never been very sociable with their fellow residents in the quarter. Someone would certainly have pointed out that marvelous patrolman to them, and they would not have made the fatal mistake of attacking a member of the police force. But the girls were so impulsive and aggressive. Without them, Dorian felt that he and his building were completely unprotected. He took special care to lock his wrought iron gate securely. Then he returned to the apartment to finish the job of cleaning up the litter left from the kickoff rally. It had been the most fabulous party of his career. At the height of it, Timmy had fallen from a chandelier and sprained his ankle. Dorian picked up a cowboy boot from which a heel had been broken and dropped it into a wastebasket, wondering whether that impossible Ignatius J. Riley was all right. Some people were simply too much to bear. Gypsy Queen's sweet mother must have been heartbroken over the dreadful newspaper publicity. Darlene cut her picture out of the paper and put it on the kitchen table. What an opening night. At least she had received a little publicity from it. She picked up her Harlot O'Hara gown from the sofa and hung it in the closet while the cockatoo watched her and squawked a bit from its perch. Jones had certainly taken over when he found out that man was a cop, leading him right over to the cabinet under the bar. Now she and Jones were both out of a job. The Night of Joy was out of business. Lana Lee was out of circulation. That Lana, posing for French pictures. Anything for a buck. Darlene looked at the golden earring that the cockatoo had brought home. Lana had been right all along. That big crazy man was really the kiss of death. He sure treated his poor mama cruel. That poor lady. Darlene sat down to ponder job possibilities. The cockatoo flapped and squawked until she stuck the novelty earring, its favorite toy, in its beak. Then the phone rang, and when she answered it, a man said,
"Listen, you got some great publicity. Now I run a club in the 500 block of Bourbon, and..."
Jones spread the newspaper on the bar of Matty's Ramble Inn and blew some smoke at it.
"Whoa!" he said to Mr. Watson. "You sure give me a good idea with all this sabotage crap. Now I sabotage myself right back to being a Vagra. Hey!"
"It looked like the sabotage go off like a nuclear bomb."
"That fat freak a guarantee 100% nuclear bomb. Shit. Drop him on somebody. Everybody getting caught in the fallout. Getting their ass blowed up. Ooh-wee! Not a joy really turned into a zoo last night. First we get a bird, then the fat mutter come dragging along,
Then three cats look like they just escaped from gym.
Shit.
Everybody fighting and scratching and screaming, and that big fat freak laying in the gutter like he did. People's fighting and cussing and rolling all around that big cat pass out.